This is the second day of this April 2010 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text of yesterday called Swampland Flowers, the Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Hui, translated by Christopher Cleary. Yesterday we read this short biography of him, and today we'll start now with the first of the letters and lectures. These are the letters. Most of the book actually is letters. And he begins by quoting the big guy, the Buddha. Buddha said, "If you want to know the realm of Buddhahood, you must make your mind as clear as empty space and leave false thinking and all grasping far behind, causing your mind to be unobstructed wherever it may turn. The realm of Buddhahood is not some external world where there is a formal Buddha. It's the realm of the wisdom of a self-awakened sage." So Buddhahood really means enlightenment. It's probably full enlightenment would be the best translation of Buddhahood. And he reminds us it's not some other place in the future or up in the sky or in Asia or anything. It's the realm of the wisdom of a self-awakened sage. And this realm is the true mind of each one of us. It's not just in sages, or you could say we're all sages in our essential nature. We just have to access this enlightened wisdom that we are all endowed with. Must make your mind as clear as empty space. Well, that's exactly what Zen practice is. Just by focusing on the breath or the koan, or doing shikantaza, which is just sitting without concentrating on any koan or the breath. By doing any of these practices, they all will take us to the same place, which is an empty mind. It is emptying the mind. It's just different ways of that we can use to empty the mind of the thoughts that get in the way of this our innate Buddhahood. And then in doing that, leave false thinking behind and all grasping behind. We don't want to be grasping for Buddhahood, for enlightenment. He goes on, "Once you are determined that you want to know this realm, you do not need adornment, cultivation, or realization to attain it." Let's make sure we understand that. Adornment, I don't know what that is, but cultivation. Cultivation is another word for practice, doing the practice. So he's saying you don't need, strictly speaking, we don't need practice to attain something we already are. It sure helps, though. It sure helps to, in order to see this clear space, empty the mind, it's practice, cultivation, that enables us to see that we don't have to attain something that we've never lost. And the same with realization. He says you don't need realization to attain it. Again, it's not in the realm of attainment. How can we attain what we've always been? That's his point. But yes, we can also say that our job is to realize that we have always been endowed with this enlightened wisdom. You know, from that, there's a line in the Prajnaparamita that we chant every day. Not even wisdom to attain. Attainment too is emptiness. You must clear away the stains of afflictions from alien sensations that have been on your mind since beginningless time, so that your mind is as broad and open as empty space, detached from all the clinging of the discriminating intellect, and your false, unreal, vain thoughts, too, are like empty space. Then this wondrous, effortless mind will be unimpeded wherever it goes. You must clear away the stains of afflictions from alien sensations. I think one way to understand that is these alien sensations is the notion that anything's alien, that anything is really outside us. This creates afflictions of the mind. That is, the fundamental affliction is imagining that there is anything other than our own mind, and that everything is this mind. The stains of afflictions. Well, these are the mental obstructions that we have acquired over the course of our lives, and even before then, over the course of many lives. These habit forces of greed and ill will, hostility in its many forms, confusion, and all of the other mental afflictions, the blind passions, jealousy, forms of pettiness and quarreling. Detached from all the clinging of the discriminating intellect. This is what the intellect does better than anything. It clings to thoughts, ideas, notions. And then he says, and these thoughts themselves are like empty space, including the vain thoughts. Vain, we could maybe understand as everything related to the self. All of our self concerns. Then this wondrous, wondrous, effortless mind will be unimpeded wherever it goes. He's pointing to a state of deep enlightenment, where we've seen through not just thoughts but everything, all forms. We've seen through the world of appearances, and this is a state of being unimpeded. Because we see everything as our own nature, our own mind. Dawei is one of these masters who often quotes earlier masters, but not by name. He refers to them as an ancient or an ancient worthy. And that's how he starts the second letter. An ancient worthy had a saying, "To look for the ox, one must seek out its tracks. To study the path, seek out no-mindedness. Where the tracks are, so must the ox be." Well, the ox is an ancient symbol of mind, our true mind. To look for the ox, seek out its tracks, seek out no-mindedness. The translator makes this mindlessness, but I think it's an unfortunate translation because mindlessness, in my experience, mindlessness is a negative kind of thing, of just being inattentive, unmindful. So I'm making it no-mindedness. The path of no-mindedness is easy to seek out. So-called no-mindedness is not being inert and unknowing, like earth, wood, tile, or stone. It means that the mind is settled and imperturbable when in contact with situations and meeting circumstances. It means that it does not cling to anything, but is clear in all places without hindrance or obstruction. It means without being stained, yet without dwelling in the stainlessness. It means viewing body and mind like dreams or illusions, yet without remaining in the perspective of dreams and illusions' empty nothingness. Only when one arrives at a realm like this can it be called true no-mindedness. Let me say more about this term, because it's a favorite term in Zen. No-mindedness is where there is no attachment to any of the functioning of the mind. We're not caught in thoughts or anything, any thought forms. No-mindedness is when we are beyond thought. Not that thoughts still don't come up in the mind, but we don't get caught by thoughts. We don't dwell in our thoughts. Being in a state of no-mindedness is allowing our true mind to function freely. And this true mind is beyond any ideas we have about it. We say there's this line in the Hakuin chant that we recite before Teisho each time, that our true self is no self. Our own self is no self. We could say the same about mind. Our true mind is no mind. Our no-mindedness is, we're functioning out of no-mindedness when there's no self-consciousness, when a musician is playing beautifully, or an athlete is performing beautifully. They're unencumbered by thoughts. They're functioning out of no-mindedness. when we're fully absorbed in our practice of the breath or the koan or shikantaza, that is being absorbed in no mind. It's this realm of empty space. And it's not opposed to the functioning of the discriminating mind. So to repeat his teaching, this no-mindedness is not being inert and unknowing, like wood. It means that the mind is settled. And it doesn't, disturbed by the winds of change. No-mindedness, I think, is just another word for samadhi. Samadhi means a state of illumined awareness. Calm, illumined awareness. A more formal definition of samadhi is the union of the meditator and the object meditated upon. So this is samadhi. We get into a breath samadhi. We get into a mu samadhi. Who, what samadhi. He goes on. Now he starts off with a quote, but again, it's not attributed to anyone in particular. Just get to the root. Don't worry about the branches. And then he comments, emptying this mind is the root. Once you get the root, the fundamental, then all kinds of language and knowledge and all your daily activities, as you respond to people and adapt to circumstances, through so many upsets and downfalls, whether joyous or angry, good or bad, favorable or adverse, these are all trivial matters, the branches. If you can be spontaneously aware and knowing as you are going along with circumstances, then there is neither lack nor excess. The root. Sesshin is designed to deliver us to the root, deliver us to this realm of no mind or oneness. Zen practice is so utterly simple. That is uncomplicated. There's nothing we have to figure out. It's just a matter of just completely merging with the practice we're working on, becoming one with. That's it. And to do that, we just have to notice when we're separate from the practice, when the mind is somewhere else, and bring it back to the breath or the koan or whatever. And then to become thoroughly absorbed, not half or three quarters or 90%, but completely immersed in the breath or the koan. That's what is so difficult, making it 100%. 100% would be a samadhi, and a state of no-mindedness, where thoughts don't are not a problem. We're aware of thoughts, little thoughts flitting through the mind here and there, but they're seen as nothing of any concern. Branches, heard about the root. The root is just this one mind, no mind. The branches are the world of the other side of things, the world of differentiation, of change, of arising and disappearing, coming and going, gaining and losing, all the things that we know so well of, all the things that are the whole world for most people, is this realm of differentiation, or the relative coming and going, attaining or not attaining. There is a verse that he quotes much later in the book is very much about this realm of no-mindedness and the root. He quotes another master as saying, "Right when using mind, there's no mental activity. Crooked talk defiled with names and forms, straight talk without complications. Without mind, but functioning. Always functioning, but non-existent. The no-mindedness I speak of now is not separate from having mind." So again, just to be perfectly clear, the higher functions of the mind, what we are using all the time in our daily lives, all of the discriminating, the evaluating and judging and differentiating, classifying, categorizing, all of that, if we're not attached to it, if we're not attached to that stuff, then that itself can be no-mindedly engaged with. It's when we cling to those things, cling to the judging, cling to the categorizing and the evaluating, that's where we get into trouble. So we're not trying to escape, in Zen practice, not trying to escape into some realm of non-differentiation, where that is somehow outside or alien to our normal functioning in the world. Rather, we want to learn to function like that in the world of differentiation, without attachment to it, without attachment to all of those discriminations we make all the time. Now he talks about tending the ox, another favorite metaphor in Zen for centuries now. He says, "Since you're on this path, then at all times in your encounters with people and responses to circumstances, you must not let wrong thoughts continue. If you cannot see through them, then the moment a wrong thought comes up, you should quickly concentrate your mental energy to pull yourself away. If you always follow those thoughts and let them continue without a break, not only does this obstruct the path, but it makes you out to be a person without wisdom." which is another way of saying it means that we have betrayed our innate mind of wisdom when we allow ourselves to pursue thoughts and cling to them. We see here the kind of the orthodox Zen position on dealing with thoughts. The moment a thought comes up, you should quickly concentrate your mental energy to pull yourself away, meaning back to the practice. And there are other practices that are somewhat similar to Zen, where it's different. It's when you notice a thought in the mind, you just observe the thought, or you label the thought. This is the instructions in even other kinds of Buddhist meditation, like Vipassana meditation. You give yourself some time to just dispassionately observe the thought that has come up until it loses its attraction, and then you return to your practice. But it's a little different from Zen. In Zen, it's as soon as you notice an errant thought, right then, as soon as you notice, back to the practice. So the teacher, the late Krishnamurti, once said, "I just watch my thoughts," and that surely is a valid method in certain kinds, his kind of teaching, but just to be clear, that's not what we're doing. We're not sitting and observing, watching our thoughts. We want to keep returning to the root, the breath, the koan. Nothing at all in the mind. He goes on, "In the old days, Kuei Shan asked a monk, 'What work do you do during the 24 hours of the day?' The monk said, 'I tend an ox.' Kuei Shan said, 'How do you tend it?' And the monk said, 'Whenever it gets into the grass, I pull it back by the nose.' Kuei Shan said, 'You're really tending the ox.'" So this is the classic metaphor for this practice of noticing and returning the attention. It's this tending an ox. You're walking along with an ox, and you got it on a tether, and it spies some juicy green shoots just off the path, and it starts to move over there. And you gotta pull it back. Come on, come on, come on, stay here. And then it takes a few more steps, and then it sees, look at it. Oh, come on, back, stay here, stay with me on this. Just keep. And you know, this is the theme of the 10 ox herding pictures, which is a portrayal, a pictorial portrayal of the stages of practice, where in the beginning it's all you can do to get that ox back and stay on the path, and then eventually the ox the mind, of course, we're talking about mind. The mind becomes more settled and less grasping at other things and so forth. Notice we're not trying to control our thoughts in this metaphor. We're not trying to do anything about the grass out there. We're just bringing the ox back. We're bringing our attention. This is the focusing function of our mind, of our awareness, where it's like a flashlight, where you have a beam of attention, and as soon as you notice it has drifted off somewhere to the side, you just snap it back. But here now, Dawei comments on this after the master says, "You're really tending the ox." He says, "People who are on the path in controlling wrong thoughts should be like this monk tending his ox. Then gradually, a wholesome ripening will take place of itself." What makes this tending of the ox so difficult for us is the ways that we complicate it. Instead of just noticing when the mind has wandered and bringing it back, we notice, and then we linger in the grass, and we compound the problem by thinking about our habit of thinking, and then we relate this to our practice. Up comes the thought of my practice. My practice is this, my practice is that. Meanwhile, we're still out there in the weeds. We're still complicating things by thinking about our thinking and judging ourselves. Oh my God, how many times am I going to have to go back to the practice? My mind is a mess. It's just, is there any hope for me? Is this, how long can I do this? Although that's just more weeds. We're still out there in the weeds, thrashing around. It's much simpler than that. You notice, doesn't matter if you've caught your mind drifting for the 100 billionth time. When you see it, bang, back to moo, 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 or the breath, or whatever the koan is, or shikantaza, just drop it. Just drop it. Don't complicate things. This is where we gum things up, is thinking about ourselves and our practice, my practice, such and such. Progress, lack of progress, time. How long is that gonna take me anyway? Jesus Christ. Or whatever one's particular version of that is. They're all different styles. They're kind of standard for each one of us. Each one of us has our particular default position that we keep repeating in the way of thoughts. Here's another letter. This one is to Li Xiongchong, and where he says, "Just examine yourself constantly, from morning to night. What do you do to help others and help yourself? If you notice even the slightest partiality or insensitivity, you must admonish yourself. Don't be careless about this." Well, here now we're in a different kind of advice entirely. This isn't just the core instructions for practice, of just coming back to the practice, but it's broadened some. It's enlarged to bring in an element of reflection, reflecting on one's tendencies. It must be what Dawi felt was what was best for this particular person. Maybe he's aware, Dawi is aware that this person has quite strong selfish tendencies, withholding tendencies, an unwillingness to give to other people. And so he says, just examine yourself. What that really means is be aware all the time. Be aware. What are you doing to help others and to help yourself? If you notice even the slightest partiality or insensitivity, you must admonish yourself. In another Zen text, this is the teachings of Bankei, the Japanese master Bankei, the translator chooses self-partiality as he renders into self-partiality what we once used to commonly refer to as our ego, our egoistic tendencies. Trouble with the word ego is it's so easy to believe in ego as an entity, some bad guy or bad gal who is creating all this evil. But ego really just means our self-consciousness or our limited perspective on reality, seeing things through the prism of self and other. That's really what that means. I prefer to avoid it usually. Sometimes it's a nice little shorthand for referring to this self-partiality, this self-centeredness, or just selfishness, or insensitivity, he says, insensitivity. It comes, the insensitivity comes from self-absorption, self-centeredness. So really what we can take from this is that all of us, part of practice is noticing when we're acting out of this me-first mind. Looking out for number one. This is such a blight on our true nature. Such a corruption of who we really are. To always be grasping at what we think will profit us. There's a story that comes to mind just this moment from way back in the early 70s at the Zen Center where there were Dokusan rushes then that were just crazy. Just full-blown stampedes with everyone at once. This is before we divided the Zendo into groups. And it was just the ring of the bell, and then chaos. It's like a thundering herd of buffalo, and everyone trying to be first. And there was one person at the time. She's one of the first people to get Kensho in those early days. And one hapless guy in the stampede, he fell down on the floor, and she just backed up and motioned to another woman, and the two of them picked him up and just helped him, got him back on his feet. Now, I hesitate to tell a story like that because I don't want people to think, okay, that's what I'm supposed to do now. It's just captures this wonderful magnanimity, this openness of being aware of someone else besides yourself. And now it's fun to run to Doksan. I'm not saying we should all let everyone go ahead of us. People sometimes ask in Doksan, well, this is always beginners. They say, why is everyone running so hard? And I thought Zen was not about competitiveness. I've learned to answer that the best way I know, which is because it's fun to run. It's fun to run. When we're sitting all day long, like stumps here, to get a chance to run, go for it. It doesn't mean being rough with other people. It doesn't mean elbowing people. And that's so against what we're trying to do here. The obvious reason that we would want to run is because there's limited time. And but that doesn't apply when you're the first group or the second or third or fourth group. You know you're going to get in. So you don't have to run for that reason in order to be sure you get in. You're going to get in, but then it's still fun to run sometimes. Well, there's a lot more in this letter, so I'm just going to stop here and we'll resume with it tomorrow and we'll recite the four vows.